Well, g'day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Fleur Meston, a young British Conservative activist. Fleur works in Westminster on a variety of campaigns and is co-host of the podcast Bombshells. Today we discuss the fight within the Reform Party and where it is likely to end up, the state of the British Conservative Party, her campaign against the assisted dying legislation currently before the British Parliament, and the likely outcome of that, and whether she sees much hope for the UK, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Fleur Meston, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thanks for having me, and good morning, I think.
It is quite early here in the morning in Brisbane. It's really good to chat to you and people in the Westminster bubble every now and then, because we get news from there and it's not always interpreted in the best way. And the big news at the moment in London is the spat within the Reform Party, right? That between Nigel Farage and I think it's Rupert Lowe. How do you think that one's going to end?
Oh, goodness knows. It's quite something. I went to an all-girls school, and it sort of reminds me of this sort of gossiping and spreading rumours behind others' backs. And it's very disappointing, to be honest, because a lot of us see Reform as sort of an alternative to the disappointing Conservative Party. And yeah, they've only got five MPs, and yet there still manages to be drama. But yeah, I think, as I can see it now, Nigel is still very much the leader and he's not going to be letting that go. And there's definitely positives to that. You know, he's the one who historically has had a lot of grassroots support and he's the big character. But a lot of people, sort of true reformers, have been disappointed that Nigel's not going far enough in their opinion with sort of calling for mass deportations in the way that Rupert Lowe is. And so they have now allied with Rupert Lowe. So if it ends up that Rupert Lowe, as rumours are saying, is going to leave and join a new splinter right party, then does all of that support go with him or does it stay with the reform that Nigel Farage is the head of? It's hard to say, but it's a bit crazy right now.
Yeah, I mean, one reason it's interesting, apart from the kind of drama, is that it's a test to see whether it's possible to get, a national populist or national conservative type of party up in the UK. We have these referenda, you know, we have a Brexit referenda, and we have the voice to Parliament here in Australia, where you get a smashing victory and you get the election of Donald Trump or other people in a national vote, but it's still unclear in a parliamentary system whether you can actually establish a new party that embodies the new right philosophy or national conservative philosophy or whatever you want to call it, right? So, you know, there was hope that Reform would be it, but it's one to watch, I suppose, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Reform as a party is new, but then it used to be the Brexit Party, so it has been around a bit longer. Obviously, they stood in the 2019 election and just were nothing really then. And now they're polling at sort of the same level as Labour and Conservatives, if not like a few points behind, depending on which polls you're looking at. It's been pretty amazing to see the appetite for it, but it's hard to say whether that's because of what they're offering as a sort of right-wing populist party, or if it's just because the others are so bad and because people were let down so much by the Conservatives, which they traditionally would have voted for. Although Reform does seem to bring together the sort of old Labour and traditional conservative right into one party. I don't know if that's causing any problems, but especially with Lee Anderson started off as a Labour MP, defected to Conservatives, then to Reform. So it shows that it's got that sort of base. But yeah, they are doing well, and it will be interesting to see if they can keep the momentum that they've got ahead of the next election. Because I know they now have more members than the Conservative Party, but they don't have any of the infrastructure or the parliamentary experience or the experience in campaigning and winning elections and writing manifestos that the other parties do have. So yeah, it's, I don't know if it will go sort of the same way as other European populist parties, or if they've peaked.
Yeah, there's a completely different skill set to that which is required to get, you know, do interesting media interviews and get people excited online, and then to build out the infrastructure where you have, you know, nice little nice men and ladies, you know, members who are handing out flyers and provide the ballast for the type of movement. And it's just unclear whether those, you know, these parties can do it. We have experience in Australia with, I guess, a national populist party in Pauline Hanson's One Nation. That started off in 1996. But again, and they say, often they say the interesting, the right things, but they just repeatedly don't have the ability to build branches, build a national network that isn't so dependent on that one leader. And I don't know, there seems to be shades of that with the Nigel Farage thing, because he's a talented guy and the rest of it. On the Conservatives, I mean, that is the other option. What do you think the prospects are for genuine change within that party?
I think they had a chance with it at their leadership election, and I unfortunately think that chance passed. Maybe in the future, if there's another leadership election, then the opportunity could come back. And I'm not saying this because I dislike Kemi Badenoch. I think she's a great MP. I agree with so much of what she stands for. But I don't think that she is the answer to the problems that caused the Conservatives to lose the last election, whereas I think Robert Chenrick was. So I think that in going back to 2019, when they gained this massive majority, they had Boris Johnson, this real character who was strong and got a lot of the sort of reform types, the old red wall, traditionally Labour voters, gained their support. But because the majority was so huge and sort of unexpectedly so, a lot of the candidates that had stood for the Conservatives were not right wing. They were sort of socially liberal and maybe fiscally conservative, but, you know, still lived in this sort of cozy world where the effects of mass immigration weren't sort of in their in their life, and so they'll support more liberal policies and challenge things which are what the voters wanted. So when it came around to the 2024 election and there was a complete massacre of Conservatives, a lot of the right-wing ones lost their seats, and the ones that had been caught up with the big majority and created this huge broad church have kept their seats. So the Parliamentary Conservative Party is still like a real broad church. And one of the things that Robert Jenrick stood on is in the leadership election was that if you wanted to be in the cabinet, you had to sign up to the idea of leaving the European Convention of Human Rights, which I know that's one policy, but if you're willing to support that, you're more likely to sort of be on board with other right-wing sort of national populist ideas and policies, and that he also wanted any future candidates that would be selected, they would have to sign up to that as well. Now, that's one, I think, very smart way of weeding out the people that caused the issues in the last parliament that lost in the election. But because the more conservative, actual conservative members were so disappointed with how unconservative that party had been, left the party, gone to reform, couldn't vote in the leadership election, we get Kerry Badenoch, who doesn't really seem to have any policies right now, and certainly is not as strong on any of the issues that need to be fixed.
Yeah, it seems to me that, and this is something other people like, you know, Matt Goodwin and others have mentioned, that Boris Johnston, when he won the election in 2019, didn't understand why he won. And it seems like a whole stack of people in what's called the Conservative Party that don't understand the new politics and didn't understand why they won. And they think of them, you know, to me, there's a divide between what I call like the anti-woke or the anti-Marxist liberal wing, which is Kemi Badenoch. You know, she says, you know, all the good things on we need to whack woke and the rest of it. And then there's the national conservatives or more traditional conservatives or orthodox conservatives, which I think is who understand, no, look, this is not just about, you know, lowering taxes and reheating Thatcherism type of stuff. The reason why they were successful in 2019 is because they were offering a different type of solution, which is one that, and it's not understood in Australia amongst the sort of bipartisan political class, with rare exceptions. But I feel like it's, despite the very articulate kind of Westminster types like yourself and others who do get it, it doesn't seem to have permeated the party as a whole. Again, with some rare exceptions, Danny Kruger types and the like, they can't see it. So that when Kemi Badenoch, you know, went to ARC and she said, you know, the problem isn't liberalism, the problem is weakness, and then talked about liberalism, and it's like, well, hang on, you're the British Conservative Party. Is there no, like, what about that philosophical tradition? Where does that fit in? I mean, is it the question problem that they don't understand it, or they don't want to understand it, the new politics?
I think they just don't understand it.
Yeah.
And the ones that do just get shut down so quickly and get booted out and silenced, like Suella Braverman. She's good MP and says things which get her in trouble but are true, and the party just like rejects her for it. Miriam Cates, she's seen as like controversial and is mocked when she's fantastic, and she, you say conservative, that's what she is, whereas you say conservative and I don't think that Kit Malthouse is a conservative. I think he's a libertarian and has just chosen that party for whatever reason. And it's these people which the party needs to be rid of if they want to have any success in the future. But they're so stubborn that they just don't. And it's almost like they're suicidal. I mean, Westminster is very cozy, and there's a lot of old alliances that cause these problems, and people giving each other positions for whatever reason. And you can't question it. And then there's, you know, Nadine Dorries talks about this Dr. No that chooses who he wants to be in. So I don't know, but they've had so many chances, and I mean, one of the biggest causes, I think, was Boris Johnson was so lucky with the position that he was given. I mean, apart from the pandemic, that ruined a lot. But he listened to his wife and sacked Lee Cummings. Boris and Cummings was great. Like you said, he didn't seem to really know what to do with it all. But Cummings was behind him. He was this popular figurehead. Everyone loves Boris. He says outrageous things. He's funny. He's like a big character, a bit of a Farage. but he needed someone to guide him. And as soon as he got rid of Cummings, it just all went crashing down.
Do you think Dominic Cummings gets the national populist or national conservative? He seemed a bit of a mixed bag, clever in a way, but a bit sort of, well, he was hopeless on COVID, so I
yeah, really know.
But so where does he now fit?
I think he gets it. I think he knows the answers. But he's just become such a disliked figure, partly by the Conservative Party, because he really went in on them after he was booted out. But also the general public, who just read whatever the BBC tells them, think, oh, this man broke lockdown rules because he went for a drive. Like, they're absolutely ridiculous rules. Like, he didn't put anyone at risk by going for a drive, but the general public's just so, like, zombie, or as he calls them, NPCs, that they think that he is, like, the most evil man in the world. You know, they will close their eyes when Keir Starmer breaks the lockdown rules, but...
I believe you had some role in highlighting, right? You
were... I did, yes. I was just, it's funny because we've got our National COVID Day of Reflection today. Mm. And so the BBC put out this post saying, share your memories from lockdown. And I was like, well, here's a memory I've got when I walked past Keir Starmer having, you know, what looked like a party, but apparently it was a meeting, but they were drinking beers. So that's, you know, the police obviously found him not to have breached any rules, but they didn't fine retrospectively. And the Labour Police and Crime Commissioner was at the event. So, you know, I think Durham is also the most corrupt police force in the country, but that's obviously got nothing to do with why.
Well, it was two-tier policing even back then, right? Even in COVID.
It was. Yeah. So, yeah, when I saw that, and I did not like lockdown, I didn't agree with lockdown. I wasn't keeping to lockdown. You know, I saw this event because I was at my ex-boyfriend's house, and his friend came in and said Keir Starmer's next door. And I was like, whoa, gotta go and see. That's like a celebrity to me because I'm a nerd. And I thought, you're pushing for stricter, stronger, longer restrictions on the rest of us whilst you're not even like obeying the ones in place. That's a hypocrite. And I think that the world needs to see this. So, yeah, but obviously.
Oh, well done. Because you're younger than, a lot younger than I am. And were you at university during those times? It just seems to me with the COVID stuff, it's an odd phenomenon because it's almost as though it's sort of, I don't know, bad taste or eye rolling or presented as boring to discuss, you know, the mistakes of lockdown. Whereas people get really passionate about Ukraine or all these other sort of issues, where, you know, there were some the economic consequences are with us still. All the debt that was racked up going to be paid for by future generations. There was major damage done to the social fabric and to the legal system. I mean, I like to say I have a background in China and I spent a lot of time there. I used to sort of believe in checks and balances and all the British and Australian beauty of the common law. I don't know. I don't believe that stuff anymore since that time. What has there been? Do you think there's any prospect in the UK, which was pretty nuts, of any true reckoning for that period of time?
They are still doing the COVID inquiry. I think they've sat this week taking evidence where, I mean, it's funny though, because they started that under the Conservatives and now it's, who obviously were in power when they were making all the crazy decisions, but now it's Labour. I don't know if that affects it. And I've not been following it because it's insane. It's wasting time, it's wasting money to still be digging this up. you know, I would like to see justice done and certain people not be in positions that they're in anymore, but you kind of just at some point got to move on and try and fix it. But it's very hard to forgive them for what they did. It was the first few years of my 20s, and that's years you're supposed to be enjoying and having fun, and we were locked up because of a virus that's average.
Wasn't going to kill you in any stretch of
the way. It was over the life expectancy anyway. It's absolutely insane, and I can't believe that it even happened. But Australia was terrible as well. So
we were equally as bad. Victoria was insane, and there are still scars there, and there's a little bit more cause for hope. There are always these false dawns, right? You thought, oh, now they're going to get it. Now they're going to get it. And now there's going to be a correction. And it just never happened after all those years where, the people responsible for it are still in revered positions in Australian society. And what about someone I've had took a particular interest in? Oh, the numerous Brits during that time. But because I think that the British still have this sort of impact, and it really was that sort of Neil Ferguson Imperial College London graph which made everyone go, oh, if the sensible Brits are taking it seriously, then we all have to. But that, no, it really was, it was a combination. I think that really was what's changed a lot of things. Someone had a graph, amazingly, but that guy is still in addition to, well, he broke lockdown as well, famously. And but is he still, respected member of British society, or is he, shunned, or is he not? I've
not heard that name in years.
Yeah.
One person who I would certainly never want to hear from again was Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer. And yet he was giving evidence to the bill committee for the assisted suicide bill that we've got going on now. And I was just sitting thinking, all of the mistakes that you made, which have partly contributed to the reasons that the NHS is doing so badly now, and we get hearing evidence from you, and he even misled the committee and had to apologise and say, and it's just like, why are we still listening to these people? It's insane. But yeah, I feel like I've got out of it unscarred personally, apart from losing a few years of fun and socializing and growing. But I was working as a nursery teacher at the time, and those children just had zero social skills. Always think about them and how they're going to grow up with that crucial developmental stage taken from them, attachment issues because they got so incredibly attached to their parents because they were the only people they saw for the first 2 years of their life, and then into school and language delays. We saw all of it, and it was, their lives, but they don't seem to matter to the people making the decision.
The UK, as I mentioned, just does seem to produce these, very well, articulate, often Oxbridge educated types who are carve out a niche for themselves in journalism or podcasting or God knows what. But there does seem to be this sort of disconnect between, these elite cultural sort of figures and the rest of the country. I mean, Australia, I guess, hasn't produced the same type of class of people for a variety of different reasons, but we have fared, I think, overall a bit better. What explains the sort of disconnect between the great words and the incredibly poor outcomes as in the nation as a whole in the UK?
Hard to say. I mean, we definitely do. I don't know. I don't feel as aware of it, but I hear Americans say a lot that we have this a very strange class system that goes back a long way where, you know, if you have gone to the right school, the right university, you know the right people, you get into the right job, then you just end up being able to have power without the merit for it. Maybe it's that. I don't know. It's hard not to sort of get my tinfoil hat on and think like they're all being paid by someone to do these bad things or without evidence. So I try and like have some discernment, but sometimes you're like, why on earth is this person in this position?
I guess this brings me to another thing. I mean, you're involved heavily in a campaign to stop the euthanasia. I mean, people use different names. Euthanasia in the UK. And there is a concerted media campaign pushing that, right? Very glossy ads in the Tube and making it all out to be this fun and progressive thing. Who is driving that? I mean, is it just a UK phenomenon, or is the push, do you think, for that global?
Definitely global. There is a global group that want everyone to have access to a system where they can either end their own life or be killed. So officially the term euthanasia means a doctor or someone injecting you with lethal drugs, and assisted suicide is you personally taking them yourself to end your own life. So we are not trying to legislate for euthanasia here, just assisted suicide. So it has to be someone that is capable of administering the drugs themselves. But yeah, the main campaign group behind this is called Dignity in Dying. But they used to be the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. And, you know, some of their old members had some dodgy links to eugenics and things like that. But they've definitely tried to distance themselves from that, including the name change. But yeah, it is very strange to me why people from other countries and are so desperate for us to have it. So in the evidence sessions in the committee stage, there were about a dozen witnesses from Australia, which was like really disproportionate. The reason they've gone for Australia is originally they were saying that the sort of sponsors of the bill here were saying Oregon was the best model and we wanted a law like Oregon because it's never expanded since 1997. But as soon as you dig a little bit and find out that the law hasn't expanded, but the interpretation has changed. So people have had assisted suicide for anorexia, arthritis, diabetes, hernias, complications from a fall, tinnitus. Then they were like, oh, we can't use this as our model anymore. We'll go to Australia and just ignore every other jurisdiction where things have gone terribly wrong. Australia is where we're going to look. So, but the passion with which these, what do they call it, VAD, voluntary assisted dying providers, spoke and tried to convince the MPs to vote for this was bizarre and misrepresenting the truth and saying things like, if someone feels a burden, that's their autonomy and that's a good reason for someone to want to end their life, was really strange. Although I do think that if you end up in a job where you are killing people, you are probably a bit of a crazy person and a bit of an extremist, so you don't get the sort of moderate supporter arguments for it. But yeah,
you have justify it to yourself too, I suppose, right? Like, you know, what are you going to work each day?
Yeah, the adverts on the London Underground were absolutely bizarre. You know, it was all of these beautiful people in their pajamas jumping up and down saying, my dying wish is to be able to end my own life. And they spent a lot of money. That is like prime advertising location in Westminster. It was in the sort of tunnel that connects the tube station with Whitehall and Houses of Parliament. So it was clearly placed there so that MPs and civil servants were seeing it on their way into work. But super insensitive, because people actually do attempt suicide on the London transport network. So to have posters of people saying, "I want to end my own life," in a place where people try and end their own lives is crazy. But they get a lot of money, Dignity and Dying does, from mainly from people's wills, I think, but also they in the past have had it from the National Lottery, or I think they received funding from a trust which also funded the Nuffield Council on Bioethics to do an independent, neutral citizens' jury on the public support for assisted suicide, which obviously came out as like everyone wants it for everyone at all ages and whatever. Yeah, there's a lot of shady stuff going on that side of things.
Why now? Because it's happened in Australia, and this type of social issue is determined at state level. A lot smaller, and I think the Brits never quite understand states, but they're able to pick them off a lot more easily because it's a smaller sort of jurisdiction. Whereas, you know, but I never quite get it. I mean, is it because people, like you say, are giving money in their wills, or that this new flood of money has pushed additional energy into the cause, or because it's always been a problem. I mean, this issue has always been with us, you know, and it's very, very sad and very hard issue in some ways. But what's pushing it now in this, you know, 2025 or 20, you know, thereabouts globally? Why?
Well, there have been a couple of attempts in the House of Commons before, and then Lord Faulkner has made 7 attempts. He's made 7 attempts in the House of Lords, including one in September. With a House of Lords bill to legalise it. But when there was a private members bill ballot in the Commons and Kim Leadbeater was selected top of the ballot, which means that she gets the most time and her choice of sitting days and basically the number one.
People, Australians won't really know.
Yeah. So Kim Leadbeater is a Member of Parliament who never wanted to be a Member of Parliament, but her sister was an MP called Jo Cox, who was horrifically murdered by a crazy man. And because of her death, her sister came and decided to stand in the constituency, and basically no one really campaigned against her because Jo Cox was a very popular, very well-liked Member of Parliament. And so Kim got in. So when Kim came number one in the private members bill ballot, this is someone who doesn't, who obviously never wanted to be an MP, doesn't really have many sort of political opinions, not strong ones anyway. And Dignity and Diet, they get a lot of, if you're selecting the private members bill ballot, a lot of campaign groups will contact you and say, please take our bill, like my one about the environment or mine about banning something, as they love to do, or legalize assisted suicide. You know, they pull on your heartstrings and tell all these horrible stories of horrible deaths, which are very sad. But yeah, they saw Kim, and Kim is absolutely perfect. She's to an extent untouchable from criticism because of her sister's murder. So every time someone criticizes her bill or the way that she's conducting herself, she does this news story of, I'm getting so much abuse, and it's almost as bad as like the levels of abuse when my sister was murdered, and then everyone backs off because, you know, it's absolutely perfect, like almost like it's by design, but I don't know if that's possible. But why now? Because we have a massive Labour majority. In the all of the other attempts, it's been a more conservative parliament. And it's not just a massive Labour majority, but it is a lot of new and experienced MPs who were faced with a huge, divisive, controversial, conscience, unwhipped vote two months into this term, when a lot of them do not know parliamentary process at all. They were getting hundreds and hundreds of emails saying, please vote this way, please vote this way. And because of, unfortunately, the public polling shows that the public think that assisted dying is not what it is. They think it's palliative care or having life support withdrawn, and support drops to like very, very moderate support rather than strong support when they haven't explained to them what it really is. So, but if they are all misguidedly emailing their inexperienced and MPs that have won by a very small margin, which is a big problem for Labour as well, because a lot of constituencies have large Muslim populations who didn't want to vote for Labour because they weren't strong enough on Gaza, and so they won by small margins. They are desperate to please their constituents. They voted for it. It's so complex how this has come about, but it's just meant that it's the absolute prime opportunity to push this bill through, when in any other circumstances it probably wouldn't go through. And I still believe that at third reading, which will be end of April, we think, that it's going to be defeated, because the committee stage has been so horrific and the public is seeing it, that I think MPs are going to be too scared to support it. I hope.
Yeah. We've gone through similar processes in Australia with these bills, and prepare to be disappointed is what I'll say, unfortunately.
No.
But there's been some excellent speeches, and it's a very interesting issue. And some of these social issues, the UK gets ahead of, well, ahead and behind is the wrong terminology, but it becomes more liberal than Australia. Mm. And behind, sometimes Australia gets more ahead of the UK. And then there's sometimes I find, for example, on immigration, right? Australia was always held up by Boris Johnson as, oh, we've got to emulate the points-based system that those good old Australians have, not knowing that it was a complete disaster and it's resulted in probably a bigger surge in immigration here than even the UK has experienced in the last 2 years. And similarly, no doubt they're trying to pull the same stunt in the UK. But the UK on immigration, there's been some very strong statements, which we haven't seen yet in the political class here, you know, net zero immigration, I think Nigel Farage's call for, and then, you know, some deportation, which that's just beyond the realm of possibility. Someone would talk like that in Australian Parliament, and even former cabinet minister Suella Braverman, I think she wants, well, there's always talk about moving it down to the tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, which again, I just can't see anyone saying that in a million years. But is that just talk, or is there any real possibility of them sort of dramatically changing basically stopping mass immigration as a policy? Yeah.
I mean, first of all, comparing to Australia, I don't know, surely you don't have the sort of same problem with small boats. And
we don't have that, but that's been kind of a blessing and a curse. So we've been able to stop the boats, but they've used that as an excuse to rapidly ramp up the numbers.
Okay.
And so I don't even think there was something that came out in the UK the other day saying it's crazy, you know, by 2025 2030, 30% of the UK will be born offshore. Well, that's us already.
Really?
Right, no, I mean, and in the capital cities, it can, depending on where you count, but it's hard. Yeah. And people don't fully, I remember chatting with Miriam Cates about that, and she was like, wow, you know, that's insane. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's,
that is hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but is there any real, you know, that Marco Rubio is talking about in his confirmation speech, talked about the age of mass migration being over. Is that going to happen in the UK at all? Or
I don't think we're there yet. I think there's a few things need to happen first. I mean, obviously, Labour sees it is a problem, and the public are sick of uncontrolled mass immigration. So they've done this, which is very strange, especially for Keir Starmer, the human rights lawyer, this whole campaign of we're deporting more foreign criminals than anyone ever before. You know, that's just a fact that we're still having like thousands of people coming into the country illegally every week, illegally, both are just as bad. But the deporting foreign criminals, they tend to be illegal immigrants. You know, obviously, you're not a very good person if you're breaking the law to enter a country. But yeah, they even had this one advert which they used the Reform Party's shade of turquoise to say we're deporting all of these foreign criminals, and they got a lot of backlash for that, of your copying Reform policies. But it's kind of smart. They see what the people want and they are pretending that they're doing it. But we had the Rwanda policy as well from the Conservatives, which I had mixed feelings about. At first, I was like, this is absolutely bizarre. Why would you spend so much more money on flying people out of the country instead of just like turning them away as soon as they get here? But then I was like, yeah, actually, makes sense, deters people. They won't come in the first place, and then you don't have any of the problem to deal with on our shores if people are going to be put off by it. But because of human rights, there's no one got deported. No one went to Rwanda, and it was a huge waste of time and money. And just think of the hours that it was debated and airtime taken up with something which had zero effect is very frustrating. But until we leave the ECHR, we can't be deporting people that should be, because they all challenge it. We've had insane stories. One man was a criminal. I'm not sure what his offence was, but he was meant to be deported, and he wasn't because his son didn't like chicken nuggets in other countries. And so, like, it's just these crazy stories that are almost unridiculous, so ridiculous that you don't think they're true, but they are. And they are reasons that foreign criminals are allowed to stay in this country. So unless we leave the ECHR, we're not going to be able to do anything. And it's so, I get so frustrated and so jealous watching what America's doing right now and thinking, it is possible. You can just do things if you're willing.
Mm.
We're not willing. Yeah.
No, I say about that European Commission on Human Rights directive or whatever it is needs to get rid of is, we still have trouble deporting. We're not part of that, and we still have trouble deporting criminals too. So even if you get that off your back, you'll be still bound by international treaties, and the legal process still will be there and take a long time. But I mean, hopefully,
how's America managing it then?
Well, I don't know that. Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, because I'm sure you wake up each day like I do, and It tends to be Christmas when you read the executive orders, and it's like, oh God, they. And it's almost as though there must be a group. In fact, I know, you know, people involved in the administration who sort of get together, and what they consider good ideas seem to bubble up and then turn into executive orders and are made law. Even stuff that I'm sure hasn't been thought of pre-campaign, and yet, I mean, the attitude in the UK towards JD Vance or Donald Trump is, I'm sure it's the same in Australia. I mean, what would be the attitude in Westminster to those guys? It would just be as popular as what?
Even conservatives, big C conservatives, as in the party, are anti-Trump and anti-Vance. It's absolutely ridiculous that in Parliament they were standing up, and before Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, went over to meet with Donald Trump, they were saying, oh, well, you've got to hold him to account on this, and will the Prime Minister denounce this one thing that Trump has said or done? And I read through the written questions that MPs ask various departments every day, and they're asking things about what, like, will they take a stance against JD Vance on this and that? And they all just act like he's some crazy evil dictator who's, they basically think he's Hitler. And it's ridiculous. Like, he was democratically elected, and I don't understand what he's doing wrong. I think his country seems to be doing a lot better than we are. But they're just stuck in this mindset of Trump is bad and Vance is bad. And, you know, do you know who Jeremy Clarkson is?
Yeah, I do, yeah. He's the Top Gear guy from in Clarkson's Farm, yeah.
Yeah, so he's like a TV personality. Mm. He wrote a column saying that J.D. Vance was a god botherer who wants women to be forced to, like, birth their rapist babies. And it's just, it's so extreme. If you think about, like, all of the world that was built by what he would refer to as god botherers, the foundation of this country and everything that he enjoys, and he will pretend to be a conservative because he likes the Cotswolds, you know, this beautiful countryside area, like that comes from god botherers. Sorry, but if you're dismissing the vice president, who I think is an absolutely incredible man, I admire JD Vance so much, especially after, I didn't read the book, but I watched the film Hillbilly Elegy about his life. He is amazing, especially from what he's come from, and he represents the American dream. To dismiss him as these two things that you disagree with him on is ridiculous. But we had so many people that call themselves conservatives sharing this article saying, this is the best thing you'll read today. They're just so small-minded. It's very frustrating.
This is the thing I find about the UK. You have these, you know, they have a way with words, these columnists, you know, and yet there's a silliness to it. Like, there's just no, and I don't know whether it's Westminster bubble or what it is, but there doesn't seem to be any true engagement with anything beyond the individual personality. You don't like what J.D. Vance's beard or Donald Trump's, you know, antics, fine, got an acquired taste, you know, but engage with the ideas, because there is a change, and he, J.D. Vance, is sort of the most articulate exponent of this new thing. He understands why trade needs to change. He understands why immigration needs to change. He understands why foreign policy needs to change. So, and they just can't move beyond. It's the same in Australia, where I have no end of frustrations here, although they don't, it's not quite done in that, you know, annoying Roy Stewart type of, you know, holier than thou way. It's a different type of beast in Australia. But they simply can't move beyond it. And it doesn't reflect well on them, the fact that they can't do that. I don't know. I mean, but the public as a whole, I guess they're reflecting the public as a whole, right? They don't, which they read the polls and they...
Well, the public just believe what they read in the media and online. And yeah, there's nothing you can do to change that.
It's a vicious cycle. You know, they spout the same thing. They hear the public and everyone's talking about the same thing.
Until people reach a point where they are so sick of the quality of their life in this country and realize, the people that we're calling bigots and Nazis and whatever with no basis for are actually making a better country over there. Maybe I want politicians like this here. But like, it's a long way off yet, unfortunately.
Do you have much hope for the UK? Because I
try to. It's hard. I try and always remember that things go in cycles, and what is it? Hard times create strong men, and strong men create good times. And I really hope that we're in the hardest of times right now. But I don't know. We're in such a sticky situation that has come from all of the things that I've already talked about, that we only have a Labour government right now because the Conservatives were so bad. And the Labour is so unpopular, but I don't know what comes next. If it's a return to the Conservatives, which feels like going back to a abusive ex, or giving Reform a chance, who was sort of inexperienced and a risk. I feel like it's going to be 4 years of suffering. I think things might get quite horrible here. But I think and I hope that the British public will have enough sense to vote for. I know that they voted for change in this election because that was Labour's slogan, is change. But I hope that they vote for change from Labour, the next one. What I find really difficult is I'm at the age where I want to, you know, I'm thinking I want to have children in the not so distant future. Do I want to have them in this country, which seems like is completely against me and is declining in safety and standards, and I can barely afford to keep myself like running and housed and fed and everything, and how am I going to do that for children as well? And also just sort of, it's really depressing here, and like I don't really like living here right now. London's not very nice, and it's not safe, and it's not clean, and it's not as bad as many places, but it's not the Britain that I was used to and that my ancestors built. But is moving to, you know, obvious choices, Hungary is absolutely lovely, or moving to America, or but you've kind of put me off Australia, but you know, somewhere warm would be nice. Is that up on the country? And what do you do? It's something I'm always wrestling with. Do I stay and suffer and fight, or do I go somewhere where I can live a better life and have a better life for future children? Who knows?
Well, it shouldn't be the case, right? That someone, that someone like yourself, can't have or a reasonable expectation of having what, you know, most Brits had, you know, which is the quiet miracle of a normal life, you know, not all the glam and everything else, but
owning a home
with a family and everything else. And I remember, you know, listening to Tucker Carlson, who's not, you know, a green voter, but he was saying, look, if your society isn't producing a reasonable prospect for someone like yourself, 23 or thereabouts, to go and form a family, then the natural reaction is we'll just burn down the system. And I just don't feel like it's unfair, the normie cons or the baby boomer class truly understand that there's no, like I keep saying, there's no self-reflection about why it truly is that the system that they've created is not producing a normal outcome for people who want to get ahead. You're involved with an organization called Orthodox Conservatives.
I'm actually not anymore.
Oh, not anymore? Okay. But in any event, like there's a whole suite of, you know, organizations which are, at least in theory, hoping to develop policies and the like, which, if there is a change of government, stands some reasonable chance of being implemented. Is that if people want to find out more about you and what you're doing, where can they track you down for?
Well, I spend 24 hours a day on Twitter. It's Flermaston. I have a podcast called Bombshells, which is currently on pause because I am spending so much time trying to campaign against assisted suicide introduction in the UK, but it will be back at some point. And yeah, that's where to find me.
Well, when's the final vote on that euthanasia bill? Is that
should be end of April?
Okay. Yeah. Is there anything Australian audiences can do to sort of, I don't know, discredit the Australians that have rocked over there lobbying for it, or
yeah, if you have any dirt on them, crazy healthcare professionals, please send it over. But and if you've got a family in the UK, which I know a lot of Australians do, please tell them to write to their MPs and tell them to ask them to vote against it at the third reading. We would be very grateful. We're in a very privileged position here where we can learn from the mistakes around the rest of the world. If only our MPs would recognize that position.
Great stuff. Well, strength of your hand. Check out Fleur online. She has a very interesting Twitter timeline. And look forward to catching up sometime in the future, Fleur. Take it easy.
Great. Thank you. Bye. Cheers.